The real risk starts to be, well, if you looked at the world today, the real risk is if anything stops, so if governments stop printing, you're going to see deflation, and you're going to see a deflationary depression. And but to the point that Greg's bringing up, is the counterparty risk is all the way down to the sand. Nothing's backing it. So if that happens, you just keep on unwinding all the way to the ground. Every bank fails, every institution fails, every government fails as a result of that, allowing the natural forces to work now, because it's counteracting a different system. So the real risk becomes a reset of the debt itself, or a wipeout of the debt itself. But because our entire system relies on that debt and everything else is built on top of that risk-free rate, everything collapses.
Welcome to the Swan Signal Podcast, a production of Swan Bitcoin. Swan is Bitcoin made easy. Automatic buys, instant buys, automatic withdrawals, and super fast account creation. Head over to swanbitcoin.com to get started right now. I'm your host, Brady Swenson, head of education at Swan. Swan Signal Live pairs great guests for compelling discussions about Bitcoin and economics. In this one, Greg Foss, longtime finance analyst, and Jeff Booth, businessman and author of The Price of Tomorrow, join us. I'm glad you found your way here. Enjoy. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Swan Signal Live. This is episode 57. Wow, we've got a great one for you with Greg Foss and Jeff Booth. Check it out. I got a new studio set up. I'm out of the corner of my home office, back into my office, my pre-COVID office, and I'm excited to be back here. Life is getting back to normal. All right. Well, Swan is the producer of this podcast, as you all know, and you can stack sats. The easiest and fastest way to do it is with Swan Bitcoin. You can set up a recurring plan and pay yourself in Bitcoin. You don't need to set up a new fiat bank account. Don't need to mess with your HR department. You know, dollar cost averaging, auto recurring buys is paying yourself in Bitcoin. Just take a percentage of your income and divide it up over a number of days, weeks, months, and pay yourself in Bitcoin. It's as easy as that. You can set it and forget it. I love hearing some of our customers say that they come back after a couple of months and check out their Swan dashboard and are just pleasantly surprised by the number of sats that they have accumulated without even remembering or thinking about it, just happening in the background while they go about their lives. And we've also started to, you know, really surprise people with the amount of sats they're stacking with our referral program, Swan Force. You can go to swanbitcoin.com/enlist and join the Swan Force. You get 25% of Swan's fees on every referral you make. We've paid out over 6 Bitcoin to our referrals, which is awesome. People are really stacking meaningful amounts of sats and having some pleasant surprises when they log back into their Swan dashboards and seeing that little surprise, that bonus there. It really works. And it's a way for you to bring your family and friends on board. We give you educational materials, free books, Inventing Bitcoin, you can give away with your referral code. So if somebody comes and downloads it and then eventually signs up for Swan, you'll be tagged for that referral. We're dropping some new books coming up soon. Gigi's 21 Lessons will be available as a download that you can use to inspire and entice your friends and family to start stacking. And there's several more on the way as well. So exciting stuff. Stack some sats, pay yourself in Bitcoin, and get paid to recruit new Bitcoiners. It's a fantastic deal all around. All right, let's dive into this one with Jeff Booth and Greg Foss. Here they are. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks, Brady.
Pleasure to be here.
All right. So these guys are from the capital T, capital N, North, the North. And it makes me think of, you know, Game of Thrones, like legends up there holding down the North for all of us on the Bitcoin front, carrying the flag. Gentlemen, you guys have been all over the place and just dropping all kinds of wisdom. Bitcoiners are really appreciating what you guys are putting out there. Greg, you've been on some awesome podcasts. Most recently, I listened to the episode on the Bitcoin Standard podcast with Saifedean that I think dropped yesterday. Jeff is the second guest on the epic What Is Money show, led by Robert Breedlove. He did that great series with Michael Saylor. And now Jeff Booth's series is dropping. I think the fourth episode is already out. It's fantastic. It's just as good as the Saylor series. So definitely make sure you go check that out. And I'm really excited because these guys are dropping such great content to get them together today for their first appearance on a live broadcast. I think we're going to have a fantastic chat. I know it's been highly anticipated. We've got a lot of input questions from the Twitter today, and that's fantastic. You guys made it easy for me for this agenda. So we're gonna answer a lot of those questions today. Let's kick it off by talking about the bond markets. This is something that Greg's been kind of railing about and talking about how fiat bonds are a fiat contract that are basically set up to be debased. And I'd just love to start with you, Greg, and get kind of a summary of the bond markets. And, you know, this on this show, we try to get establish a bit of kind of history and underlying stuff. We've got a lot of new people to Bitcoin, new people to, you know, what is money, how the economy is working, all that stuff. So we're trying to lay a foundation more on this show as well, as we get a lot of new Swan customers watching this. So could you give us sort of a basis of, you know, how the bond market functions, why they're important to the global economy, and how they've sort of changed in the way that they function over the past, you know, 10 or 15 years?
Sure. Well, firstly, thanks so much for having me. And Jeff, it's a pleasure to be on our podcast together. Jeff and I've conversed back and forth, both on Zoom, never met personally, but yeah, very proud to be here and honored. So sort of neat. You've invited me on, and I'm just glancing over my shoulder. So I see on CNBC, Rick Santelli talking about the Fed decision. So that just came out moments ago. I'm anticipating no change in policy. For anyone who is wondering, that's the Fed Reserve had a two-day meeting. The Federal Reserve, as everyone knows, sets short-term interest rates generally for the world almost, okay? Everything trades off the U.S. Treasury curve. It has been defined in economics textbooks as the yield curve of the U.S. Treasury is the quintessential risk-free rate. That's by and large true, but it's not accurate to 100% because even the U.S. Treasury now is starting to trade in the credit default swap market. And what that means is the market is paying a premium to ensure credit default on the U.S. Treasury. It's not a large premium, but it's not zero. And this is what we need to understand. There is credit risk that's starting to develop in all sovereign debt markets. So I had basically a 30-year career trading credit. I started in at the Royal Bank of Canada. And what is a bond? A bond is a fixed income contract. It's an obligation, very simply. It is varying lengths to maturity. It is traded on a price basis. What it comes down to, though, is it sets a yield that is a cost of borrowing for any counterparty that you lend money to. And the U.S. Treasury is, as I said, the base level of rates across the world. But there's corporations that borrow money, municipalities. It's all a contract, and that's very important to understand. It's a contractual obligation to pay a series of interest coupons semi-annually, generally over time, that are fixed until maturity. And that contract can be broken. And when it's broken, it's an event of default. It is superior or prior claim to any equities in the capital structure. And therefore, I say anybody who owns an equity better understand where the debt of a given corporation trades, or else they're not doing their homework, because the debt has prior claim. And many equity analysts are, quite honestly, unaware of the debt profile of a company and the risks that accrue there. So very simply, bond markets matter so much because not only are they larger than equity markets, they are more liquid. They also have prior claim in a capital structure. And I believe that credit gives indications of valuations far before any equity markets sniff those out.
So, Jeff, we had a question related to this from Status Quo on Twitter. You said that in episode 4 of the What is Money podcast, the most recent that has dropped, said you talked about how the inflation rate sets the floor on bond rates. And he's curious about how shrinkflation plays into that equation, if at all, or if it is just a way to hide the real rates from the market for a little while longer for, I guess, more pain.
Well, this is exactly what so Greg's looking at it from a different angle, but it actually converges exactly the same. So what caused, I look at it from what caused the debt buildup. Greg looks at it from what, how big are credit markets and what is, what's going to happen next. And so he's completely right. People are looking at the equity markets thinking they're going up, and the credit markets is where really all the action happens. And so I look at what I wanted to say, what I explored in the book and others, is if you have deflation or technological deflation, that what governments are doing is trying to counteract that. And that has been the low interest rate policy to try to drive growth against that. And the lower interest rate policy of constant lower interest rates causes debt bubbles and people to misallocate capital and bring more more debt. And then when that can't be paid, then monetizing debt is what happens. And the real risk starts to be, well, if you looked at the world today, the real risk is if anything stops, so if governments stop printing, you're going to see deflation and you're going to see a deflationary depression. And but to the point that Greg's bringing up is the counterparty risk is all the way down to the sand. Nothing's backing it. So if that happens, you just keep on unwinding all the way to the ground. Every bank fails, every institution fails, every government fails as a result of that. Allowing the natural forces to work now, because it's counteracting a different system. So the real risk becomes a reset of the debt itself, or a wipeout of the debt itself. But because our entire system relies on that debt, and everything else is built on top of that risk-free rate, everything collapses. So you have to ask yourself: will governments allow that to happen? And I think quite simply is they can't. So they will continue to print and to pretend that that debt is still repayable. And so they default in a different way. And that's where we are in the cycle right now. And so what you're starting to see is the CDS spreads are rising as a result of knowledge of what's going to happen next.
How widespread do you think that knowledge is now, Jeff?
Well, so I think a lot of people in specifically in Bitcoin are understanding that it's the best risk-free trade in the world right now, and the more and more people are starting to understand that, and that's actually why a wall of money is coming to Bitcoin, and more people are starting to get that, not just individuals, but now companies and eventually sovereigns and themselves as well is what's happening. But how wide is that knowledge today? I would say really, really narrow. It was so small, because, and I've said this so often, we measure a system by the system we're in. So even though everything we're talking about is true, it's factual. They like try to defend anything, like poke holes in what we're saying. and from a first principle standpoint, you can't. So that means that the existing system requires manipulation and exponentially more manipulation to survive. And if you think, what is actually inflation? So inflation is, and this is going to sound harsh, but it's true. So if you take something from somebody else without their knowledge, is that theft? And you would say, so if you took something from somebody without their knowledge, it's theft. I know that's a harsh word, but it's theft. And so when you transfer wealth from the middle class and poor to the rich because of inflation, and you hide it, and even if people don't know, it's theft. And so then you should ask, what is it theft if it's 2%, 3%, 5%, 20%? right? Theft is theft. And so what's happening right now, and more people are understanding that theft and the consequence, more the geopolitical consequence, the rise up of societies and everything else, and the wealth divide, they were understanding that consequence more. And so what is the existing system going to do? We're going to create more theft to pretend we're going to save you. And so that's what's happening today. And more and more people are investigating this on a first principle basis and starting to understand that the world they lived in might not be as true as they think. And something's going to change. So, but today, a very, very small percentage of people understand what we're talking about.
And I would, can I jump in? It's even in the credit markets, okay? Even in the credit markets, there are bond guys that come back at me. Well, have fun. I'm sure you made a lot of money shorting those Canada bonds. And meaning the price of the Canada bonds went in my face if I was shorting the bonds. And I wouldn't short the bonds. The bonds trade down because they're manipulated down. You need to own protection. You need to own an insurance contract that is not manipulated by a central bank that can be reflected in open market forces. It's a floating rate premium, has nothing to do with or no direct link to inflation expectations. There is from a credit perspective, but you need to watch those credit spreads. And I go back to the great financial crisis in 2008. And the credit spreads were the early warning system, the canary in the coal mine. Okay. I lived that. I traded at a hedge fund with a very famous Canadian. I'm not sure if we've ever brought his name up, Jeff, and I'll talk to you about him later. But he was an equity guy that basically said, Fosser, here's all, and he had a large position in the fund. Take all my risk and manage it from the equity side, excuse me, from the credit side, because equities don't matter. Okay. Yeah. Equities are the tail of the dog. And the dog is credit. And when the credit market is not happy, equities get destroyed. Very simply, why? Because credit guys can hedge a subordinate claim. If you have sold protection on a given name, you can run to the equity market and do option strategies or outright short that stock because you've sold a default insurance to some other person that needed the insurance. And therefore, you run out and in the subordinate claim in the capital structure, you, for example, could have shorted Lehman Brothers, and Lehman Brothers equity starts spiraling down, and then the crisis in confidence. So, you know, not jumping on top of you, Jeff, but the truth is, yes, it's a minuscule portion of people, even in the credit markets, that understand credit default swaps. It's a brilliant invention by two young ladies out of JP Morgan in New York, obviously New York, and they developed a market, and that market is very valuable, and it's often an early warning system. And even when it's functioning, you know, even when there's a fire, there's still protection. It's like they're trading fire insurance during when your house is on fire, because maybe the house doesn't burn to the ground. And all of this is very key. It is such an important innovation in the markets that separates inflation from credit.
And let's just build on that for a second, because even the CDS market, Greg, and I'd love your comments on here, because even that isn't understood well. Those spreads are essentially assuming the counterparty could pay, right? And yes. what happens on those spreads, and so even the CDS market can't tell you the truth on how bad it is, because it requires a counterparty on the other side to pay that. And what you realize is going down the stack, it kind of a wall of nobody can pay.
You're 100% correct. Sorry, but imagine if somebody had purchased, let's say Greg Foss had purchased default protection on Lehman Brothers. Just saying, I did not do that, but let's just say I did. But imagine if I had purchased it from Bear Stearns. Totally. And imagine then I was thought I was hedged, but Bear Stearns is going down, cascading downwards as well. All of a sudden, I'm concerned with my counterparty risk on Bear Stearns, because it's not direct Bear Stearns. It's an insurance premium I'm paying to Bear Stearns to hedge me against Lehman Brothers. Then all of a sudden, I have to run out and say, my God, I got to insure the insurer. And then, you know, that again is
the next one. Who's the next one?
So that's the domino effect. That's why it happens. So you're 100% correct. The counterparty component is such an important component. And we'll talk about this later, maybe bringing up the aspect of AIG and what that would have meant to Goldman Sachs if they had let AIG fail in 2008. So over to you guys.
So can you just like you said, very few people understand credit default swaps. And I think you gave a good analogy there about trading insurance on a burning house. But maybe go just in a little bit more detail about how these credit default swaps work. And I know that they obviously played a big part in the 2008 crash too. So maybe use some examples.
So sure, Jeff, I'll take it first. And then Jeff, please jump all over me. Here's the reality. So every bond spread, a bond will trade at a spread over the equivalent term US Treasury, okay? And that spread is to compensate lenders for three different risks. The primary risk is credit risk or default risk. Now, the two are sometimes used interchangeably, but they're not exactly the same, okay? The default risk is an expected event because every group of corporate bonds will have some defaults unless socialized all losses and you have zombie companies. But in the past, when markets were somewhat open, you had an expected loss. Then there's an unexpected loss, okay? That's the volatility of the default rate, okay? That spread is captured. Then there's a liquidity premium because there's no way that corporate bonds are as liquid as the U.S. Treasury. So an investor has to be compensated for those three. Within there, some very smart ladies, as I mentioned, at J.P. Morgan took and said, well, because every single corporation doesn't have bonds that mature every single year or every 90 days, we're going to construct a credit default swap market that starts issuing in the 5-year term and every 90 days rolls down the curve. So a reference obligation, call it XYZ company, has 5-year CDS, credit default swap, based on a reference obligation that might be a 10 or 20 year bond that if that bond defaults, that triggers the contract being paid. But this 5-year CDS spread is issued as a 5-year maturity, and then it becomes 4 3/4 years, and they issue another 5-year. And the beautiful thing is you have a 5-year CDS market and a credit curve for that company every 90 days. Okay. And these contracts trade and they roll some guy says, I want the on the run contract. So I'm rolling out of my 4.5 year and I'm moving back to the 5 year. And these beautiful contracts go into credit structures and credit indices so that you can measure, much like equity markets measure indices, you actually have credit market indices based on CDS pricing all along the curve. And it's a very valuable instrument for hedging a number of things, including Bill Ackman, who very astutely went out when he saw COVID coming and bought a whole bunch of protection on the investment grade corporate indices in the US. He was actually doing an upside down trade. He was hedging his equity by purchasing CDS on a basket of other credits. Now he put this on in huge size. Okay. And we saw the results. He made huge returns. Very smart. Helped him hedge the bottom part of his capital structure. Some of the names appeared that he owned down here, Hilton Hotels, also were in the protection he was purchasing. Well, quasi hedge, quasi upside down trade. Nonetheless, he was paying that insurance premium at a time before the insurance providers, before the market said, whoa, premiums are going to explode. Why would I sell at this price when in 3 months' time I'm going to be able to get premiums that are 4 or 5 times higher? Okay. Bill Ackman was smart. Most trades don't occur in that upside down basis like that. Again, most of the trades start in the credit market and flow back to the equity market. But all of this indicates what is possible when you have a fluid 5-year CDS market. It is needs to be purchased from a counterparty, as I mentioned. Think of the counterparty as your insurance company. When you purchase fire insurance, you go out to an insurance provider that sells you the fire insurance. CDS is the same exact concept. You are paying a premium on an annual basis to insure $10 million worth of debt for a given premium. And the wider that spread is, obviously, the more risky that credit, the implied risk of that credit is. So very fluid market, very, very helpful market for pricing a corporation's true risk structure. And again, it gives so many clues that the equity markets have, you know, generally are not on their radar screen.
Jeff, do you have anything to add there?
I just say, is it what really happens in this? And I'm going to speak specifically to the counterparty risk. So what Greg said, so when you manipulate markets, obviously you can manipulate these curves, right? Because you now think about what ends up happening to the counterparty risk though. And let's go back to 2008. And I have a company in 2008. So Greg is in credit swaps, everything else. Greg knows way more than I would ever know. But I have a company, and this is what the company looks like. We cannot, we have money in our bank, and we have a letter of credit buying containers of product from around the world, letters of credit, and the counterparty banks won't take our money, won't take the letter of credit. Because it's based on this. And I'm talking for about 3 days that the markets stopped. So I knew what was going to happen in kind of the Fed going in and printing and liquidity in the markets and JP Morgan essentially becoming a bank so that they could have access to that window of free money and Goldman Sachs becoming a bank too, because the counterparty risk would have taken the entire system worldwide to the sand if they hadn't. And so what's happening is you're constantly forced to inject more liquidity. And it's kind of a bluff. We're going to get into this, I'm sure, a lot more. But governments saying that, okay, they're going to let the free market work, they can't. It's impossible now. It's just math. They cannot let. I wish that wasn't true. But it is true, and they will. And so now we're all talking about, okay, when will they print? When won't they print? When we know for sure they have to print for a lot more forever now because the corresponding is a complete unwind and reset of the system. And so we could get into the short-term actions, what happens in the stock market, what happens in the bond market, and each of these actions. But we know the long-term game on what it looks like.
So what do you guys, I mean, here's another question from Colin that's somewhat related. And yes, you know, this is a particular that Jeff was just talking about that we can kind of get in and debate these particulars. But we know overall, in the long run, the outcome is that there's going to be more printing. But Colin wants to ask about one of these details. And he says, at which point and at what rate along the yield curve will the Fed likely implement yield curve control? And how soon might this realistically happen? Who wants to jump on that one?
You want to jump first, Greg?
I will. You nailed it. Let's wrap it up. It's only math. Okay. Okay. So it's very simple. It's only math. You're right. It is impossible not to continue printing because the total debt to GDP spiral is at such a point where the growth of the numerator, i.e. because of the organic growth of debt due to a coupon, is growing at such a pace that global GDP cannot possibly keep up with it. Okay. So that's the math. What fills in the error term is fiat currency, print, print, print. So yes, we know they have to print. So yield curve control is another tool, call it a tool, in the Fed's ability to manipulate the cost of risk, if you will, the borrowing cost. And, you know, I personally don't believe the U.S. is going to come out, and I can't be certain of this, and target a term where they are, call it the 10-year term. We're going to target the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield to be, and let's take it what it is today, 165 basis points or 1.65% per annum. they might target that and say, we are locking the rate there. I believe that they're going to focus in the short term. It doesn't matter anyway. Okay. I actually think if they come out with yield curve control, people are going to run to the CDS market, the credit default swap market, and say, it's actually getting worse. I need to now purchase more protection. And it actually may be, you know, a sign that they are losing even more control. So we go back to what Jeff said. It's actually just math, 100%. Fiat currencies are now going to be printed forever. It's the only solution. And do I want that system to fail? No, I don't actually want that system to fail. What we need to find is a solution for a store of value that is not fiat currency, because supply and demand would just indicate that if you print more of something, it becomes more and more plentiful. The value of the existing currency that's out there should lose its value, correct? And you know, the beautiful guys in Bitcoin and Breedlove and money is a technology to store energy and time, the value of work time and energy over time to be consumed in the future. It's a technology, right? So if you accept the fact mathematically that fiats are going to be debased, that is a good conclusion. Therefore, hedge yourself. And yield curve control, in my opinion, it could manipulate the cost of capital, the perceived cost of capital, but flipping the other side, my credit view might say, don't do that, guys. Like, you know, the US is going to be the last fiat or one of the last fiats in the world to fail. And the impact of an almighty US dollar is already reverberating around the globe. They do not want the US dollar to get that much stronger, because every time it does, every single country in Latin America basically goes into depression. Okay. Yeah. Historically, that is the case. So you need to be careful what you implement when you are the de facto world reserve currency, which the US dollar is. Yield curve control can work in Japan. You know, Japan benefits by not being the G1 of the G7 nations. It's what happens in the G1 nation, which is the US, that really matters. So I don't even want to speculate on it. I would just advise them not to do it, because from a credit perspective, it's like playing poker. And you're like, oh, okay, the guy is trying to bluff.
But Greg, if you just take that forward, they have to. Mathematically, they have to, because if interest rates went up to what the market would charge the interest rates,
yes,
or the free market would charge interest rates, the entire economy starts unwinding to show that what's been there all along.
So I think we're saying the same thing. Sorry to jump, except that when I say yield curve control, they're absolutely doing yield curve control right now. They're just not locking it in. Right. I wanted to speculate, or not speculate, I want to say they're going to lock in the 10-year at 165. No, they'll do their $120 billion of bond purchases each month, of which MBS, mortgage-backed securities, is a certain amount. And of course, they're going to shape the yield curve to their desired using, but they're not going to lock it. If they lock it, in my opinion, that's what YCC is, yield curve control using a lock.
Got it.
So this plays out. We don't know exactly how long it's going to take. All they can do is print. Then, I mean, does this end up eventually, and this is sort of my hope, in some kind of socialist, fully socialist, universal basic income type social safety net that, you know, just dishes out, you know, these checks straight from the Federal Reserve. Let's say the Federal Reserve puts together a central bank digital currency. You get your bank account directly with the Federal Reserve. I'm sure all the corporate banks are going to hate that, but it seems like it might happen. And then, you know, you get Fed bucks straight, deposited straight into your phone wallet from, you know, every month. I personally think this might be, you know, the best way into hyper Bitcoinization, at least the fairest way, because, you know, at the end of this collapse, you might as well throw a little something to the plebs who have been suffering under this Cantillon effect for all these years. Do you guys see that as a possibility? Do you think we've sort of been trial ballooning this during the COVID response?
So Okay, this is going to take us pretty deep down down the rabbit hole, because that's a really complicated answer. And it ties into human, what we think, what we say we'll do versus what we'll do at a mass level. So if you think about what inflation is from a first principle, you're actually stealing from the middle class and poor and gifting it to the rich. So on one side, we know that that's true. And you're concentrating more and more power in the government to say they're helping the poor as a result of that. So now think through that process. Now we're going to do that faster to help the poor and remove the free market from this, because essentially on that path, eventually everything becomes a managed economy. And we know that how that ends, because you concentrate all power in government, and we know how that ends. So that's and what will they do? Because the thing they're doing is actually the divisive nature of society, but the society doesn't know that that's actually what's happening. The people that have their pocket picked are actually screaming for more assistance without realizing they're having their pocket picked. But that's what is likely to happen. So now let's imagine where we are in Bitcoin cycle right now. And this ties into why I really care about it. So I have to say this, I understand why a whole bunch of people in Bitcoin would say have fun staying poor, because you're so deep in this and you understand it so much and what's happening. And when you hear this FUD arguments and everything else, it's really, and you just get tired of it. And trust me, I do too. And it's just easier to come back with that. But now let's think about as a system unwinds. And Bitcoin is this thing that it actually could provide abundance for humanity. It's a really powerful instrument. But as Bitcoin unwinds up, the more people on Bitcoin the more people lower in the social economic ladder that understand Bitcoin, that it's not just for the rich, it's for everybody. More people that understand that and can share in that, the better for society, because there has to be enough people willing to fight for this new monetary idea versus the old. But now let's say it starts breaking down. Let's say today the system breaks down, and today it goes through deflation, a deflationary depression, like we're talking about, and it starts unwinding. Because that's the natural market, that's what should be happening. And by preventing recessions, we created something that's going to be the mother of all depressions. So that's what the free market says should happen. And the other side of that is concentrating wealth and power and government control unilaterally. Let's say they break down, it starts breaking down today, and we let the free market emerge. That means everything else fails. Banks fail, governments fail, everything else fails. And there wouldn't be a place to hide in citadels in that type of environment. But now think about what that means, where roads, bridges, every hospitals, everything else collapses. And what will society do if there's only 10% of people on Bitcoin? And we even think about Bitcoin itself, if you have a silent majority of 90% of those 10% of people that won't fight for the protocol. The existing system wins, or they create a digital bank, digital currency that operates, that takes control unilaterally because people demand it. And a whole bunch of people who say they would do one thing when they don't have any money will go for a short term of what the government says. And if you look at Myanmar today, on what ends up happening, if you look at through history of what ends up happening when a whole bunch of people are left out, it empowers a totalitarian state. It actually, and a lot of people say they would fight against it, but then don't. So at a high level, what I would say is we need more Bitcoin adoption, and we need it to happen slowly. Or we need it to happen fast, but we need it to happen. We don't want the existing system to collapse tomorrow. It won't collapse tomorrow. It's going to reverberate back and forth and everything else. But we need to get more and more people to understand this message that Bitcoin, it does empower human beings. It puts it's an individual right and freedom, and it's a huge deal. It's way more than the money you'll make.
So I would agree 100%, Jeff, really well said. And I'll point out that Jeff covers this very nicely in his book. I believe it's in one of the last chapters of the book, but you should read that. So universal basic income, yes. I'm not gonna cover that. You know, Jeff did beautiful justice. I just want to take a step back, and I believe that there will be a parallel system for a good period of time. All right, because fiat currencies take a while to fail, and after all, Argentina in my lifetime, Argentina has failed a number of times. Isn't that crazy? I got my start in finance working at the Royal Bank of Canada in 1988. And one of my first projects was working on the Latin American Brady Bond Plan for countries south of Mexico, including Mexico, that had failed. And then Argentina fails again. And right now, Argentina is not looking so good again. So as long as the big boys in fiat, again, the G7, the G1s to G, let's even call it G20s or G15s, they can continue this, and they don't fail overnight. And Jeff is right. And we don't want them to fail overnight. We just need to make sure we are operating a parallel system to store our wealth and help the people that Ponzi, the fiat Ponzi, is punishing. The fiat Ponzi is punishing the people that want UBI. We need to teach them about the benefits of a store of value that is, you know, Bitcoin, essentially. And so I won't do any justice. Jeff has explained that it's a social dilemma. There's a status quo bias in human nature. Yes, yes, yes. The good thing is, and we're lucky, let's be honest, you're very lucky. Brady, you live in a G1 country, and we're sort of lucky. We live in a G7 country, but rapidly becoming a less than a G7 country called Canada. And that does not make me happy. But imagine what's going to happen if Canada hits some of these, which it will before the US does. The US better take notice, because at one point in time, we were the US's largest trading partner. We may be number two now behind China. I haven't seen the recent statistics. But when your largest trading partner starts sewering, you better take notice. And I guarantee the US will. But all of the other defaults that have occurred up until now, and restructurings and currency crises, are in countries that I'm really sad to say, most of these countries don't have the GDP of 30 of the top US states. You know, each US state has a bigger economy than these countries that fail on a regular basis. And that's why you have the IMF and all these other institutions trying to draw up things called special drawing rights and all of this. UBI, as Jeff said, the key component is it is actually harming the people that they're trying to help. And that's why we need to educate that portion as to why Bitcoin can move them from their continuous debasement or theft, Jeff calls it, in terms of inflation and the like, how they can change their position meaningfully in a store of value proposition.
I mean, yes, it would be harming them unless we can convince them and educate them to buy Bitcoin with it. And if that were the case, then maybe it would actually be helpful.
How about if a central bank actually did it for them?
Oh, totally. Oh.
You know, what if you actually had management of a country that was smart enough to realize, hey, it was gold, but gold is, yeah, sort of gold. This is so much better. And actually, I'm the CEO of a country, and I'm making a decision, a fiduciary decision for my stakeholders, which happens to be your population. And I am managing their risk by putting some of my reserves into the purest form of money ever invented. Okay.
Just like people before them and corporations before them, but this is inevitable. This is what's going to happen.
And as soon as that happens, boy, oh boy, is there going to be a gap up. Michael Saylor calls it a rip. call it a face melting rally, whatever you want to call it, but don't be short Bitcoin when that first central bank, and by being short, when I say don't be short, you better own some, because if you own zero, you're short, right? So you better own some for when that central bank comes out and says, you saw today there was a Japanese company that put 100 million. 100 million is a rounding error. What happens though, is you get 100 million, 100 million, 100 million, and pretty soon you're talking billions, and then you're talking hundreds of billions. And oh my goodness, can you imagine if one of Canada's energy rich provinces actually came out and said, you know, Bitcoin is digital energy, and I've decided to embark on this reclaiming the natural resource base of Canada and getting paid in a beautiful form of money. Man, Jeff, would I want to be part of that country? And all of a sudden, all the people that are leaving Canada would actually say, hey, maybe I'm going to come back. And I actually personally know close to 20 people who have left Canada to move to tax havens in the Caribbean and the like. Each one of those people are not leaving because, they're really bullish on Canada, let me tell you, okay? And that's a bad thing, because as soon as you lose that tax base, you're not left with a whole lot left, right?
I said that recently to... I won't say who, but a politician. I said, listen, if Canada ever went after this, I'm leaving, right? And and with all the companies and everything else, they can go anywhere. And so if a government now starts threatening kind of Bitcoin and everything else, you can imagine what ends up happening to their economy. They best leave.
100%. That's, there's a word in bond trade. Well, it's a word in everything. And unfortunately it's true, but, crap rolls downhill, right? And the people that get, that are left are the people holding the bag. And, hey man, I love my country. I know you do too, Jeff. And I'm going to do everything I can for my three kids to actually further the Bitcoin cause, further the education process, and actually make that link. Digital energy, Jeff points out in his book, is responsible for human productivity improvements, the growth of cities. Every single invention is magnified by an increase in electrical productivity, et cetera, et cetera. Hey, that's what Bitcoin is. It's engineering. It's a thing of beauty that can save things. And you'll get your socialists out there that say, well, we got to tax this and tax that. Okay. I'm not saying don't redistribute a form of taxation or a form of wealth, but do it with a plan in mind, meaning take it to the extent that you're managing a business and you want some of your reserve assets in a form or a store of wealth that will someday be worth many, 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 many multiples of what it is today. Some of that's due to the fiat measurement unit of account, which is guaranteed to debase, but most of it is due to its scarcity and 21 million hard cap. Very, very simple supply and demand.
See, and I came to this in writing the book and everything else, and you know, because Bitcoin's a very small part of the end of the book, but I came to this in a how could a system work? Give me any solution. A plausible solution that of a system that can work, that can increase abundance for people, to humanity thrives where we're going. And on finding none and looking everywhere for what could this look like, you realize Bitcoin becomes that system. And until there's something that people that is a credible something else, but I haven't seen anything, and you can imagine I'm open to it. Look all over, and I'm going to get a whole bunch of people and altcoins now and everything else. But, but finding none, I'm Bitcoin until something changes my mind, and I am all in.
So on the subject of Canada, just wanted to check in on the particular situation there. Some questions in the thread about just, you know, the status of Canada, and you guys have talked about some of the concerns. There's a politician, Pierre, I'm not good at French, Poilievre. Poiliev. Thank you. I was making it more difficult than it is. Pierre Poiliev, who has, you know, been making all the arguments the Bitcoiners make about what the Canadian banking system is doing. And have either of you been in contact with him or other officials of the government? And is there any hope for Canada to, you know, at least make the arguments in public forums from public officials in defense of Bitcoin?
I'm going to say this without, so once you understand Bitcoin as a human being, forget politics aside, everything else. Once you understand Bitcoin as a human being, it's really hard not to get all, go all in and start to try to convince others. Those others are human beings that are also elected officials. And governments change when more and more people understand what's happening. And some of those elected officials start to realize what's really happening and they become more powerful because a lot of people understand what's happening and governments are changed. So without, you can imagine some of the conversations that I'm privy to, and that's not just government conversations or CEO conversations or hedge funds conversations. This is a conversation with everybody I know that's accelerating. And there is nothing that the existing system can do to stop that from accelerating because it's true. Everything. So have somebody argue with what kind of this thesis on a first principle basis. And not go back to, no, I want to concentrate all power in government. I want to remove the free market because that's the alternative. And so so when you actually have the truth on your side, the truth spreads really quickly. Now add the truth on your side and a whole bunch of brilliant minds in an ecosystem that are expanding and sharing that and building on a protocol that is inherently fair and built across humanity, time and space, it's pretty hard to stop because you have to manipulate to stop it. You have to scare people. You have to fear monger to stop it. And so what's happening in politics and what's happening everywhere, hedge funds, politics, everywhere else, is more people are coming to the realization of this. And I will say this. Pierre has become a friend through first him having the curiosity to understand the thing they're dealing with from reading my book, and then more and more curiosity around that, whether or not when he gets to Bitcoin, what that looks like and everything else. But it's not just him. There's a whole bunch more people that are starting to move that, and you build really great relationships when you do what you say you're going to do, and that and it's true.
So Pierre is an example that not all Canadian politicians fell off the turnip truck, right? The guy is brilliant, and I will say a little story from a side. I've been trying to reach out to him. I have not succeeded yet. But he definitely gets it. And this is a neat little story, because the avenue I was using was with a young lady who lives in Ottawa, and she was a sportscaster, and she's the wife of a good buddy of mine from Montreal. And she now is the, runs a very large, institute, foundation for, collecting money, for charity. And she reached out to me and said, what's this thing, Bitcoin? Can you explain it to me? Cause we have members that want to, or donors who want to donate in Bitcoin. So I hooked her up with one of my buddies who, runs custody and everything. And about 3 months later, she called me back. She goes, this is so beautiful. This is such a cool, product and store of value. And I understand how it works. I actually got her financial advisor to download a Bitcoin wallet and everything, but she knows Pierre personally. They're in Ottawa. She was a you know, involved in some of the same, certainly social circles and everything. So I was trying to go through that, that avenue. It seems like Jeff, obviously is, you know, with his book has achieved more than I have. But the point is this, you get foundations, people in foundations that are raising money on behalf of less fortunate people or circumstances or hospitals or whatever, that are accepting Bitcoin. And then they're talking to the politicians. They're trying to get other people to talk to the politicians. Yeah, it does work. And that's what I think Jeff is saying. There is a theory in money management. It's called the theory of agents. And that's very simply says, as long as my competition isn't doing it, then I don't have to do it. And that was the same thing with high yield bonds in Canada for the longest time. No Canadian institutional investor wanted to touch high yield bonds because they were too risky. Now, as an aside, most of them owned the equity of the same companies, but they wouldn't buy the debt. But that's, you know, that indicates they failed finance 101. Doesn't matter though. What it meant was nobody bought the bonds of high yield companies. They all had to go to the US market to finance themselves because bonds are for capital appreciation, capital preservation, and equities were for capital appreciation. Well, over time, 20 years, first, it was one account based in Vancouver. Jeff, I don't know, a lot of good things come out of Vancouver. There was one institutional manager in Canada that started buying high yield bonds for their clients to differentiate themselves from the pack. And all of a sudden, the other money manager said, geez, this guy's actually attracting money. He's attracting clients. And I'm losing clients to him. So the theory of agents was, oh, nobody's doing it in Canada, so nobody has to do it. Oh, one person does it. Well, I'll just tell you today, every single major money manager in Canada has a bucket for high yield bonds. It's going to be the same thing for Bitcoin. I've seen it happen in my 30 years. I was the first high yield trader in Canada. Okay, most of my clients were in the United States, but I was trading Canadian high yield debt out of Canada. Most of it was in US dollars, again, because that's where the high yield junk market was. But I would hedge it using Canadian equities. And Canadian equity managers were like, what the heck's going on with my equity? I just happened to be shorting it. I wouldn't tell them that, but I was hedging my high yield bond position using their equity. Long story again, theory of agents. Cover your eyes. I don't want it to succeed. I don't want it to succeed. You know, it was only 12 months ago that Goldman Sachs was out there saying Bitcoin's not an asset class. And then about a week ago, it now appears on their portfolio attribution reports. Wow. That's in 12 months. They went from saying it's not an asset class to putting it as, and by the way, where does it appear in their attribution reports? Oh yeah. The very top, highest return, best Sharpe ratio. Sharpe ratio, for those who are inclined, divides it by its volatility. It's right there. And every single portfolio manager now in the world has to wake up every morning and look at Bitcoin being at the top of the asset allocation chart. And the clients are no longer, hey, why do I own Bitcoin? It's now, hey, dude, why the heck don't I own Bitcoin? I mean, it's right there, right in front of your face. So slowly, 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 and then suddenly. And again, when one central bank announces they're doing it, don't you think? And I saw in the comments, yes, somebody said Temasek is doing it. All true. I'm talking, this will be huge when a Russia starts taking payment for their natural resource energy in Bitcoin. They don't want US treasuries. I guarantee you they don't want US treasuries or US dollar. But that's what oil is priced in. So let's price oil in Bitcoin. Oh boy. That's going to change the world.
So let's talk a little bit about how things are changing in Bitcoin, with institutions coming in and companies putting Bitcoin on their balance sheets. Speculation that, you know, oil-rich countries might start trading oil in Bitcoin, as Greg just brought up there. ARK Invest and among many other institutions looking to spin up an ETF. So there's big players in the game now, and the way that Bitcoin is traded, the way the Bitcoin economy works is changing. I'd love to hear your guys' ideas on how, you know, this financialization of Bitcoin might change the way it works, or like the way that it's, price appreciation or adoption moves forward. And Jeff, you can jump in on this one.
So
So there's a whole ecosystem being built around it. So and we're so early in that ecosystem. it's really like looking at the internet in 1996 and saying, what will it look like today? That's what's happening. So it's so to give my forecast, but I do think it emerges as an asset class and then a currency over time, whether eventually governments are forced to peg to it, buy it on their own reserve, moves into currency. We'll see. I suspect in the end, all of those things, but on a path, we'll see kind of it because of our recency bias too, our human being recency bias. And I'm not saying yours or mine.
Yeah.
We're all on Twitter today and everything else. Well, what happened today? Oh, this person acquired it today. And we miss the larger trend. Like if you step back and watch what's happening, it's really obvious. And so I already know the play. I already know what the playbook is. I know what the game board looks like. And what's going to happen? Yes, there's going to be some movements, short term movements in that game board, but I'm playing the right game. That's so I'm going to give you an example because here's a piece of FUD. People believe that if Bitcoin moves way up and nobody ever sells it, well, how can an economy work? Right. So how could you invest some money in a different company? And while it is true today, I would never sell my Bitcoin to be able to buy a different business or anything else. It is not true that I wouldn't make investments where I thought the only reason that's true is it's not true that I wouldn't make investments in other companies that I thought could outperform Bitcoin. And why they would outperform Bitcoin is because they're delivering tons of value for society.
Yeah.
So and as Bitcoin reaches, so it's just the hurdle rate for my investments is way higher than it would be in a fiat system, because I'm not giving up my Bitcoin unless that entrepreneur and that value that they're creating is staggering high to be able to beat that return. So it doesn't change to say we wouldn't spend our money in a Bitcoin standard, like really. So I'm not going to eat. I'm not going to. It doesn't make any sense. So, but I would say the longer term trend, because of all these kind of these thoughts, this FUD and everything else, people don't see what's really happening underneath. But the whole ecosystem is going to change radically on the way through and bring more and more attention and price appreciation through the whole thing.
So I agree. Great. Well said, Jeff. I was a founding shareholder in a company in Canada that brought the first closed-end fund, Bitcoin fund, trading on a regulated stock exchange, the Toronto Stock Exchange. So it was not GBTC because GBTC trades on the pink sheets in the US, which is not regulated. It's not New York Stock Exchange. I was a founding partner. The truth is I would have done, let's just say I did it because I viewed this to be an asset class that Canadians were going to start. So Canada brought the first closed-end Bitcoin funds. There was more than one. And then, lo and behold, we bought the first Canadian ETFs. And I saw Canadian Bushman, I'll call you out. I'm not sure who you are, but I love your comments on the chat right here. He mentioned correctly, Canadian Bushman says, yes, Canada has some ETFs. So you did, Brady brought up the name Kathy Wood. Now, she is one of the most astute investors in the world right now. Kathy Wood was a founding partner of the same company in Canada that brought this closed-end fund to the Canadian Stock Exchange. I've met her. She's an extremely brilliant lady. Her team is extremely brilliant. And when she talks things like Tesla, I'm not certain that, you know, I agree with her price target, but the fact that Elon Musk owns Bitcoin in his personal portfolio as well as on his balance sheet, and Kathy Wood is one of the largest proponents of Tesla stock out there. Once again, we get the feedback loop. Once again, we get people who are talking and spreading the gospel on Bitcoin. Now, you know, oh my God, Elon sold 10% or excuse me, Tesla sold 10% of their Bitcoin last quarter. Yeah, so what? I mean, they bought $1.5 billion. They made a ton of money. There are not always hodlers in the world, okay? The way the world works, and I'm a trader, I tell you, I love Bitcoin. I'm never going to own less than a core position, but I trade it every single day. I love taking VIG out of the market. I'm not picking anybody off. They're sellers for whatever reason. Elon sold because he wanted to book a profit and fund his free cash flow negative company with some Bitcoin profits. It's not a, you know, he could have sold other things. Saylor would have said, Elon, issue more debt. But this is all part of a process of evaluating a proper cost of capital. That's where Jeff nails it. It's about a proper cost of capital. Now, Jeff says, there are some equity investments that might have a higher return than Bitcoin. I think I'm involved in one right now. It's an energy company. Wow. Isn't that crazy that an energy company may be a better investment than pure Bitcoin? I'm not saying 100% certain it is, but if it's producing Bitcoin using natural resources coming out of the ground, and we're the best at it in our country, well, I think that could be something that will build value over and above the price appreciation of Bitcoin. Am I wrong? I don't know, but I'll tell you, I'm hedging my belief in Bitcoin as the system, okay? And that's what Jeff comes right back to. It's about a system, an ecosystem that comes from Kathy Wood, comes from Canadian Bushman. Second time I'm calling him out. I'd love to meet him someday because he seems like he's passionate about this. It comes from passionate investors and passionate people who believe they found a better solution. Fiat exists as a currency. And I brought this up on Safe Dean's thing. It was BTC Sessions, I guess, or maybe both of them. You've heard that thing about... maybe you haven't, and I'll say it again, about a guy with a cow in a village, and he's walking with a cow and a for sale sign on it, and it says, this cow's for sale for $600,000. And the townspeople are laughing at him, $600,000 for a cow, you're an idiot. No, no, no. 3 days later, he's walking through town, he's got three chickens. And the guy says, I told you you'd never sell your cow for $600,000. He says, darn right, I did. I sold it for these three $200,000 chickens. Like, it just makes no difference, right? It's only a valuation. Now, what if the guy actually wanted 3.5 chickens and he wanted them to be live? Well, that's when currency comes into play. That's why you don't actually have to chop a chicken in half and hope it still lives if you wanted 3.5 chickens for your one cow. Don't mistake what a currency is in barter versus what money and a store of value is in asset management. And that's the difference between Bitcoin and a fiat currency. A $600,000 cow. It's coming, guys. I'm afraid it is. It's horrible. It's coming. A $600,000 cow.
Jeff, what do you think about the Tesla move? I mean, I saw Documenting Bitcoin, one of my favorite Twitter accounts, said, hey, Tesla just stress tested. Yeah, just stress tested Bitcoin. Did it pass Elon Musk? And he just replied, yes. This is good, right? This is not just Bitcoin functioning as a long-term store of value to be hodled. It's functioning as a treasury reserve asset that can be have enough liquidity to be, you know, transferred into another currency to be used to pay bills.
So that's one part of it. Absolutely true. Now, but just think about how Treasury works. I'm on a bunch of audit committees and everything else. And Treasury work requirements work at a typical company. So they might work different. First of all, they might work different at Michael Saylor's company because he owns 25% of the stock. So he is a huge owner. And so he has more influence on that. But in typically in Treasury, if you kind of set up in an audit committee, you would manage the risk of your, let's say currencies. You'd hedge, just like Greg's talking about, you'd hedge Canadian and I'd have some US currency. So I would hedge my risk on currency failure in a multiple in my Treasury. And so what Elon did is he inserted Bitcoin into that management. So to reduce risk onto his Treasury. Which makes tons of sense. And it might have happened. I don't know. I'm not in the inside of that company. But it might have happened that they set up some, okay, it can be, here's how much in allocation for each currency. And then as a result of putting it in there, the price exploded. and the amount his position is went out of balance from the current rules that the audit committee set for the treasury reserves. So he had to sell down. But well, and then again, what he said is it passed a requirement. So that might have been forced on him anyways. We don't know. But it also passed the requirement, and he holds it personally. So it's two different things. But what will happen on a feedback loop to that is it'll tell the more and more of the market that Bitcoin is a great hedge against currency yes. risk, and we need to put it on our balance sheet as well to hedge that currency. And in Tesla itself, it might say to the Treasury, maybe we should increase our allocation percentage to Bitcoin over time and change our rules of the Treasury to protect shareholders.
Exactly. And you know, when you're free cash flow negative, that means you have to raise capital to expand. You know, you can issue debt, you can issue equity, but don't forget he reports to equity holders who may not want to be diluted, and who may, a big fund that owns him may turn around and say, Elon, instead of raising $100 million from me for your free cash flow deficit, why don't you just sell some of this equity, some of this Bitcoin you bought on your balance sheet, I embraced it, and use it and prove that it functioned exactly like Jeff was saying, okay? It was a reserve asset that was able to be sold. It wasn't one directional. It did go up, but they liquidated a portion of it. And it gives the people that he's managing for, his board of directors, comfort that they could increase their position in the future or use it as a store of value that at a time when they need to raise or pay for capital expenditures, they decided to use that asset that was on their balance sheet.
Exactly. Did we lose Brady?
I'm not sure. He did go, but it might be just you and me now. I don't know if we're still live. We'll see if we're still live. But you know what's neat? And I wanted to bring this up, Jeff, is we have Canada and we were talking about Pierre. You know, we need to sit down with him, or somebody needs to sit down with him and explain where Canada's trading in the credit default swap market versus our implied or our AAA credit rating. Okay. The funny thing is we're trading as a single A credit in the CDS market. So don't fall prey to the fact that our credit rating by a subjective credit rating agency has dictated that we are AAA. The market, the open market for risk is telling us, no, you guys are much closer to a single A credit. Man, oh man, that's a terrible, terrible situation. And it's the truth.
That's really important because most people wouldn't look, but if you look at the CDS spreads, we're trading. That's exactly right. We're trading at an A.
and you know what? All the credit rating agency is going to do is put it on watch for downgrade. That's going to cause more people to say, "Oh my God!" So it again, a subjective credit rating can lead to itself an inefficient market, right? And you know, they arbitrarily set something called investment grade versus non-investment grade without considering price. I mean, God, who would ever make an investment and say it's investment grade without considering the price? And there's always a price that makes a non-investment grade subjective opinion worth making an investment in. It's your return anticipation, right? So
you mean the same rating agencies might do that?
The same guys that you know, happen to have such a big impact on the global financial crisis and the subprime mortgage fiasco and structured product, all stuff I traded. And come on, do you think you guys were pretending they were getting a spread of 200 basis points over risk-free treasuries, but it was rated AAA? Anyone who took that to their investment committee and their investment committee bought that baloney, that investment committee should be fired. Mm-hmm. Believing that the market was paying 200 basis points over when a normal AAA credit would pay like 25 basis points over. Come on, don't fall for these shenanigans. And I'll just throw one other thing out. Yeah, it's interesting who does pay the rating agency. Oh, it happens to be the issuer. So there's a, you know, there's a conflict of interest there too.
Brady's, he's lost power in the middle of a storm.
No way. All right. So should we keep going? I'm not sure what to do.
I have a hard stop in about 8 minutes, but we could keep going.
Okay. So, look, so Go ahead. Why don't I need this question answered. I'm looking at Eddie. Eddie, can you tell us what that question, if hypothetically a central bank owned 100% of a corporate bond, could the equity still have value even if the company defaults on its debt? The answer to that, Ed, is no. Okay. The reality is you just push it down in the capital structure. A defaulted bond then becomes the equity of the company. They restructured around an equity position, and the old equity, you'll get crammed down in the capital structure. It's called a cram down. And generally they'll throw you a few tidbits of, okay, this equity, will give you some, it becomes an option value. Okay. So everything gets crammed down. Now, central banks, up until the COVID crisis, central banks did not buy corporate debt, but the US Fed said, we're going to buy corporate debt and high yield debt to be specific. And why was that? Because there were four credits in the US market: General Electric, Ford, General Motors, and AT&T. Those four credits, if they had been downgraded one credit notch, because they're right on the cusp of this line called investment grade versus non-investment grade or junk, if those four had been downgraded, they would have overwhelmed. The cumulative balance sheet on those four companies is bigger than the entire high yield market. Okay, that's why the Fed had to hop in and say, I'm buying high yield bonds, or I'm making these lines available to buy high yield bonds. Unprecedented, but very simple again. When four of your major US companies, if they got downgraded, and they generally get downgraded in succession, would have overwhelmed the high yield market. And guess where that flows to? You're right, the equity market. So bang, 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 and then boom.
All right, that one ended in a little bit of a strange way. My internet connection dropped. The guys continued there for a little bit and ended in a really fun way with Greg going bang, bang, boom. So that was fun. Sorry for the hiccup there. Thanks to Greg and Jeff for joining us. You can find Greg on Twitter at Foss Greg Foss. That's FossGregFoss. And you'll find Jeff on Twitter at Jeff Booth, JeffBooth. I am at Citizen Bitcoin on Twitter, and you'll find Swan at Swan Bitcoin. On behalf of the Swan team, thank you so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Swan Signal podcast. It is fun to join us live on the YouTube broadcasts at youtube.com/SwanSignal. Head over there, subscribe, turn on the notifications. We have a lot of fun in the chat, and we often work in some questions from listeners. You can subscribe to this podcast if you're not already at swansignalpodcast.com. Swan Signal is a production of Swan Bitcoin at swanbitcoin.com, the best way to accumulate Bitcoin with automatic recurring buys, instant buys, and automatic withdrawals.